From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. It's always good to have old friends do the show. And the last time the gentleman sitting across me was here, we were talking about someone to eat cheese with.
How about that?
How about that?
Wow.
My guess.
And I do remember talking to you about it.
I'm glad somebody remembers talking
to me. In Santa
Monica,
we talked.
Well, now we're talking here not far from Santa Monica.
Yes, in Culver City.
In Culver City. My guest, of course, is Jeff Garland. And his new Netflix special is Our Man in Chicago.
Yes, sir.
First of all, you see the show. It starts off, well, it feels like, almost like, in mid-show, and you're wearing a suit.
Yes.
A suit and tie.
A suit and tie. A suit that was made on, Savile Row.
Savile Row. Huntsman. Color me impressed.
Yep. Had two of them made, picked between them. Also had the Huntsman tie.
I guess it makes sense then that Jeff Garland starts off his new special talking about how successful he is since he's wearing $7,000 worth of clothes in it.
That is, by the way, near the beginning of the special where we start showing it. I don't like the walkout. I think the walkout's wasting everybody's time.
You don't want an entrance.
Nah, I actually, in all sincerity, I'm too humble for an entrance. It unnerves me, and I feel embarrassed by it. Like, I don't need to show that the audience is excited to see me. Let me prove it by getting laughs and having them dig me, and you go, oh, they like him. You know, walking out and getting a big applause. What does that do? I don't need
that.
So
there's calculation in that.
Yeah.
That was a choice you made.
A complete choice, without a doubt. Knew it before I even, like, even though they filmed me walking out, I knew I wasn't going to use it.
Wow, because you also say something in this show that makes it different from any show that you've done before, which is that this show has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
For me, that's quite unusual, beginning, middle, and end.
Talk about that. About
well, I worked for about the past 3 years preparing for this. And what I did was I always improvise. I create my stand-up the same way I would put up shows at Second City in Chicago. You improvise until you have a scene, and then you make the scene, you work it, and then the scene's perfect. So I always
still leave air in the scene in case there's some place to go on stage.
No, you don't do it on purpose.
Right.
You let it breathe no matter what. If you're present in the if you're in the moment, you can go any direction you want to go, no matter what. But I completely prepared to have a beginning and middle and end because I knew I go up on stage. If you were like, I'm at the Improv on Friday night, I'll do an hour. And I literally have no idea right now, nor when I'm walking to the stage, what I'm going to talk about. I have no idea. And I will go for an hour. If I'm reminded of something, I might talk about it. But generally, I'm making it up for an hour, okay? And I record it. So that way, if something is kind of interesting, I go, oh, let's save that, you know? However, no idea. So I developed all this material. And I did two shows in Chicago. First show was maybe, like I say, most of my nights, I'm 90% improvised, okay? But maybe the first show was the reverse, 10% improvised, 90% beginning, middle, and end written. And I felt like, great, I've got it. And then the second show, I came out and I was on fire. As they say, I captured lightning in a bottle. And I would say that show is about 50-50. And that's the one you saw.
I can tell because, not to give too much away, but about halfway into the show, there's an entire digression where Jamie and Lydia become a part of the
evening's festivities. Oh, my God, yes. It's a young couple going through unrequited love. I see that he's experiencing that with her, and I recognize it, being an expert on it. What is it, Patty Chayefsky, an expert in pain, a professor of pain from Marty. And so I understand that. I mean, Marty's at the core of all my humor, you know?
Well, Marty and Stan Lee, because they're, don't forget, I
call. Oh, Stan Lee, sure. Yeah. I mean, Spider-Man, Goodnight Nurse, the original, like the early comics of him in high school. To this day, that hits me at my core.
Stan Lee, Steve Ditko.
Do not forget Steve Ditko, most certainly. That and the Silver Surfer that Stan Lee did with John Buscema, and also he did him originally, Stan Lee did it with Jack Kirby.
In Fantastic Four.
Now, those are characters with loneliness, who fail, have failed in love. It's pretty exciting. I loved it. It did things that you never saw with Batman. Although I love Batman, but you never saw that with Batman. You never saw that with Superman. I mean, even though he had the glasses with Lois Lane, he's still Superman, you know?
Well, it's that great line that's in the Jules Pfeiffer book, The Great Comic Book Heroes, about...
By the way, anytime anyone quotes Jules Pfeiffer, I am thrilled. I don't sit across from people and go, as Jules Pfeiffer once said.
Again, as I like to say, my guess was a low threshold for being thrilled. Is
I
Jim
am. By the way, simple things excite me and thrill me. And that
people often look at me and say simple things. I'm used to people saying simple
things. So do you remember the Jules Pfeiffer quote?
Well, basically he's going on, Bruce Wayne is pretending to be Batman.
Right.
Superman is pretending to be Clark Kent.
Yes.
That's the difference.
That's the difference.
And it's actually the bit that Quentin Tarantino stole/paid tribute to.
Right.
In Kill Bill Volume 2, where David Carradine gives that speech.
Yes.
But anyways, we're talking about this, creating characters. I guess this is something I've always wanted to ask you, which is how much is Jeff Garland we see on stage is Jeff Garland the persona versus
100%.
That's all.
Not 99%, 100%. There is no differentiation except for I have more energy. I'm a Gemini, June 5th, okay? So my two sides are either gregarious or reflective and pensive. And I've been reflective and pensive on nights where I completely improvise, sort of seeing where I'm going, what have you. But those are the two sides of me.
We can feel that here in this show. We can feel that reflection because there are moments, again, maybe my favorite thing you do on stage, and we get to see you do it here, to recap.
Yeah.
Because, again, this digression that you do here, which is...
I'm big on digressions.
But you also bring us back, which is something I've seen you go out and digress and then say to recap and then further digress.
Right. I'll always come back to where I was, always. And it'll always become clear, even though along the journey you may go, where is he going? It'll all make sense.
Has that always been important to you to keep like one story that has a through line that you're going to go through on the entire act?
I don't do it consciously. No, it's completely unconscious.
Okay, because I always thought that was a way to keep a placeholder just so you know if you get through that story, that tells you where you are.
You know what's interesting that I discuss with other comedians? People think that we're so aware. And truly, I'm thinking about maybe what I ate at that moment. Like on Curb Your Enthusiasm, I'm in the middle of a scene and I'm quiet. People go wondering what I'm thinking. And I'm literally thinking about craft service, like something they screwed up, or I'm thinking about something I'm doing that night or whatever. And by the way, any real comedian, I mean somebody who's actually funny and does it, believe me. If you're watching Dave Chappelle, he can think about a recipe while he's talking and doing his magical stuff. We can think of numerous things. Our minds have all these caverns that we go into while the other cavern's working. It's kind of weird.
Does that become part of the thing, too? Because as you're thinking about other things, those other things that are swimming through those caverns are things you can bring onto the show.
Without a doubt. I'm staying present to not only what's happening around me, but I'm staying present to what's going on in my mind, going down a path. And then sometimes I'll go, should I? Once I do that, I've almost already ruined the moment. Like if I think, should I say that? You know, they might not react. They might not like that. But then it's a matter of my gut telling me not to. And whenever I say it anyhow, it doesn't work. So if your gut says, yeah, go now. Boom, from some thought that you had that was deep in your mind while something else is going on, and you do it, it generally works. But if my voice says, should I? That's me telling myself, don't.
Really?
Yep. And you have to learn to trust that voice.
So it's always been that, should I? And because I wonder, as you say, should I, that part of you is asking yourself, how adventurous do you want to be? How big a chance do you want to take? What is that, should I, a really way of saying, ooh, no, 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 no.
Well, by the way, yes, yes, yes. It is about the risk, but my gut tells me whether or not I should take the risk. See, that's why stand-up is, people say, a tightrope. And, you know, like if I'm making a film and I think of something the same way of the should I, what does it cost me to film it?
Okay.
Except for a little bit more time.
Right.
You know, but why not take that risk? And then in editing, I can have the clear mind, almost like an outsider, going, yeah, do that. You know, But I don't have the editing process except for my own voice when I'm up on stage. It's in the moment.
But is the audience has to become part of the editing process too, doesn't it? I mean, doesn't the audience kind of tell you where to go? Or, because again, going back to that should I voice, I wonder if the should I voice is saying, these people need to be pushed. Some part of you is saying, this audience needs a little prod. They need a little bit of current. They need a charge.
Right.
I need to do something with these people that they're not expecting. Does the should I voice do that?
The should I voice is doing that all the time when they're a bad audience. And what you're describing is a bad audience.
I'm at public radio. We don't judge. We merely pose a question.
Now, by the way, when I say bad audience, there's a real specificness to that.
Go.
Okay. An audience is made up of people, different backgrounds, education, jobs, the way they were raised, their DNA, what they had for lunch, what they had for dinner, what the weather's like. All these things are mixed into a room with all these strangers. Boom, you get what you get. And so some nights, it ain't a groovy situation. And I can become a craftsman in those situations and get through, but at no time is it joyous. And if you want to see me at my best, which is, by the way, in our Man in Chicago, that is, I captured what I do at my best, which blows my mind even today. I'm so thankful that I was able to do that because what are the odds?
Did you know as you were doing it, it was your best?
Okay, so dig this.
Go.
And we're talking about the young couple with the unrequited love. In my head, while I'm in the moment and improvising, I am literally thinking, is this really happening? This is great. Oh my God, this is like playing a little room like the improv or Flappers in LA in front of 100 people and no one knows about it after it's over. It's being captured. What I do, I literally was jumping up and down in my mind. I could not believe it. So yes is the answer to that.
Okay. Short question, long answer.
Yeah.
That's okay. That's what public radio is about.
Yeah.
But I mean, because there is something... Because I've seen you literally jump up on down on stage before.
Yes, yes.
And here, you also made a decision about playing it a little cooler than you normally do.
My biggest influence, comedically, is Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Sonny Rollins. In terms of what I'm doing, the improvisational aspect is more Coltrane, is more... By the way, actually, the person that I would most compare myself to is Monk. Playing the same song differently every time. You know, I'm influenced by jazz greats. That's where. So to me, in a suit, being present and the way I'm standing there, that all goes back to late 50s, early 60s jazz.
That's interesting because it's seeing you in that suit made me think of you as being presentational for the first time.
Well, by the way, I have to be presentational. I'm filming a stand-up special, and I'm generally not presentational.
Exactly.
Yes.
You've done that before. You haven't worn a suit.
And exactly.
That's a very different
thing. And by the way, Our Man in Chicago is based on Dexter Gordon, Our Man in Paris.
I was going to ask you where that came from.
Yep, Our Man in Paris and Our Man in Havana.
Yes, of course,
indeed.
A little bit of Graham Greene there.
And I love that movie, and I love the book, both.
Okay, well, my guest contains multitudes. He's Jeff Garlin. His special is Our Man in Chicago on Netflix. This is streaming. We have to take a break. We'll be back. There's more to come. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm being effusive with Our Man in Chicago, Jeff Garlin. That's the name of the special on Netflix. It's The Treatment.
By the way, I want to say, being on The Treatment right now, giving credit, the show, Our Man in Chicago, just went out for a review, just went out for, are you interested in having him on your show, this, that, or thing. You are the first person to respond. I want to give credit because, by the way, I am so excited about the potential for this. I feel... personally, that of my generation, I am the most underrated stand-up comedian.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know why. I haven't figured it out.
Let me offer you this.
Okay.
You do so many things.
Yes.
Because a lot of comedians who basically get to a much later point in life and they start doing film stuff.
Right.
And they start doing other things. You've always been somebody with your hands in a lot of pots.
Yes.
And because of that, I think, to make a really clumsy metaphor of it here, it's hard to draw a target on you for that reason.
Well, that's the reason I'll take it, because I like doing it. Like, I'm a photographer. I have my first show at the Leica Gallery.
You're a photographer.
In January.
You could have called the show, you know, Our Man with His Les Paul.
I
don't want to give away.
No, I play guitar. I'm into guitars. I'm into photography. I have my first photography show. I produced Finding Vivian Mayer, you know, the documentary nominated for
Filmmakers of the Year.
Yeah. By the way, that's my, people have approached me about doing more documentaries. I'm like, no, I'm one for one with an Academy Award nomination. I'm done. I never entered it into it for that. I did one and I'm good. You know, that's the way to be. Yeah.
But you know what I'm saying though? Yeah. There's a loss if you do
that. By the way, that is something to think about that I've never thought about.
It's funny because when we met, when you introduced yourself to me at Amoeba Records, we should say this is back when the ArcLight had just opened, and we were both wondering if this thing was going to succeed.
Right.
I was talking to you about all the stuff you do, because you seem to be surprised I knew who you were.
Right.
And
I still, to this day, anyone who comes up to me, I'm always like, oh, thank you. You mean, because I am never, assuming that someone doesn't know who you are is a much cleaner way to live. It's a much better way to live.
I've had to put it on business cards.
Yeah.
But I think that as we're talking about you not quite being as neatly defined as maybe other stand-ups are. Because, again,
I'm not, that's for sure, yes.
But it's, as we sit here and talk, just the number of references and the things that interest you and things that you pursue.
Yes.
And it's not that you're a dilettante about any of these things,
right.
You know? That these things are all things that you're passionate about. You know, be it, I'm sorry to say, Chicago baseball or Chicago jazz, no small thing.
Or
comics or film.
Yeah.
And it's not just comic film, comedic film, I mean to say, but all kinds
of
film.
And I know a lot about blues. That's why I love guitar. Because of the blues.
Yeah, you're playing the blues on a Les Paul. No small thing.
Yeah. Actually, I have a Les Paul, but a Gibson ES-335.
That's what that was.
Yeah, that's the blues guitar. Les Paul's not as much known as a blues guitar.
That's why I brought it up.
A Strat. I've gotten to know Buddy Guy a little bit, which has been one of the most exciting things of my life. And he signed a guitar to me recently. Wow. One of his polka dot guitars. It's so, I love that. I'm passionate about a lot of things, and maybe I don't have the strict focus just on stand-up, although I always tell my children, take what you do seriously, don't take yourself seriously, and I like living by that, and I take my stand-up comedy very seriously, and I don't take myself very seriously.
It's interesting, too, because, again, I wanted to get back to, by the way, it's a treatment we're talking to our old friend Jeff Garland about his Netflix special, Our Man in Chicago, that you actually are treating the audience as if you're there to give them a show rather than so many of your shows, be this stuff that's been filmed, the things I've seen you do, are about you like reflecting before the audience. I mean, you're actually like treating the audience as kind of really like a pad, like a tablet, you know, and
oh, they're the whole thing, man. That's it. It's even, I mean, even I Curb Your Enthusiasm, we interact with each other as if the other is the audience. It's just being, the audience gives me the energy that I feed on. It goes back and forth. But me, myself, being an improviser, I am really dependent on it. You know, I'm not as presentational, so I have to, you know, go with where they take me, where they give me. But I feel like it goes back to I was the funniest kid in high school. So I'm hanging out at lunch with a group of kids listening to me ramble about stuff. That's how I am with the audience. They're my friends.
Oh, and you even say that at one point during the show, which is how the whole thing with Jamie and Lita set in the first place.
Oh, yeah, because then he touched me or something, and I said, you can, it's okay. Like, yeah, and I started talking to him like he's my pal and empathizing with what he's going through with her. And by the way, when you see this, it'll make more sense if you watch this, ladies and gentlemen, but she was a doll. She went along with clearly this dude's in love with her. And she went along with the whole journey. And hopefully they make it together because they look good together.
And there's a really great callback to another audience member with Lydia. I don't want to get into it because I don't want to get too much away. But I find myself watching this thinking, and I hate to use the word mature, but I'll say this is Jeff Garland in a different phase of his life.
Without a doubt. Yeah. I'm a man. And I approach everything in life as a man. And I don't mean that I mean that a real man is vulnerable. A real man is thoughtful. A real man is present. A real man is kind. So I like approaching it like a man. I'm no longer a boy.
Because I wondered, too, I was going to ask you about the title, Our Man in Chicago. That was part of the reason that you chose that title.
Yes, without a doubt. He's our man in Chicago, without a doubt. I am from Chicago. The way a Midwesterner is, the way a Chicagoan is, that is at my soul who I am. The work ethic and, like I said, the thoughtfulness. People in Chicago are inherently good, kind people. They really are.
But it's also not our boy in Chicago or our guy in Chicago.
And by the way, I used to go up on stage all the time to Muddy Waters.
Manish Boy?
Manish Boy. Yeah. Being a man child, if you will. I liked that. But that was me in my 30s. I'm a 57-year-old man. I should be behaving like a man. And that's how I like to be.
Because that's very much a part of what this is. I mean, because the moments when you pause, as often as not when you would pause on stage, you were basically caught in thought. Mm-hmm. But this time, you're looking at the audience when you pause, mm-hmm. which felt a little different to me, if you mm-hmm. know what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, you're actually keeping the audience in this thing at all times.
Yeah. I'm tied in with them, especially that second show that I described, where it's like, oh, my God, we're one unit. We're symbiotic. If it's like an old alien movie or something. I mean, it blew my mind. When I was done, I couldn't speak because I had captured something that I only dreamed of capturing. Think about, first off, when I was a young comedian, there'd be anywhere from a dozen to, let's say, 18 comedy specials, however they came out, whether someone from a movie theater, Showtime, HBO, it was pretty limited where a special would come. Mostly a dozen HBO, mix in some Showtime, one or two movies.
They actually felt special at one point.
They were very special. But even those, of those, how many of those are classic? How many of those capture? Now, you have probably a half dozen being filmed a month, okay? And of those, like when I sit and I watch Netflix or HBO, generally it brings about depression because I love laughing. I root for other comedians. I don't look for them to fail so I look better or feel better. I look for them to succeed. When I watch John Mulaney, who I mentioned in the special, when I watch his specials, I'm giddy. I just watched Gary Goldman's new special. I was just so thrilled that he was taking such a risk. And it had a beginning and middle and an end. And same with Mulaney and same with other people. Then I watch people who don't have the goods. And when they don't have the goods, you know how you know? Because they're living and dying from one second to the next. It's just bits. It's not even jokes, like the way a classic Henny Youngman would do one joke, or Rodney Dangerfield would do one joke, and then the next joke, and the next joke. No, these are like bits and routines that really have nothing to do with one another. And what it's basically saying is, I'm funny, I deserve to be out here. And if that's what you're trying to say, you shouldn't be having a special. You need to get to a point where your special is like you're making an album, man. You're making an album. You're making a living and breathing thing that's going to live.
My guess was just summed up comedy and desperation in the same sentence as Jeff Garlin, his new special on Netflix is Our Man in Chicago is the treatment. Because there's so much about this. And it was kind of thrilling for me to watch because I haven't seen you for a while. It's good mm-hmm. to see you.
Yes.
But also good to see how much more comfortable you are in your own skin.
Without a doubt. That's what happens when you become a man. It's joyful. I know who I am. Takes a long time, man. And by the way, women are so lucky. They come to it so much younger than we do. They are so much more advanced than we are. But to become a man and know who I am and be and live in that skin is so joyful to me that, wow. You know, that's why youth is wasted on the youth. I mean, that saying makes so much sense. But women have it down way before us. And I feel bad that most women, all they are offered are boys to be with. And you know, yeah. Well, and by the way, this pops in my head. I'm talking fully heterosexual here. I'm not an expert on the other areas, and I respect all of them, whatever you're into, man. I'm groovy with it, but I'm just saying that women who are interested in men, you know, it's a lot of boys, and being a man is a privilege and an honor.
We're here at public radio. We don't make those kinds of judgments,
John. Right. And there are no judgments here. That's it.
To our own thing.
Yeah.
But speaking of judgments, and we've got a little bit of time here left.
Yes.
You start to talk about your addictions, and you said milkshakes, and there was a bit of a giggle in the audience, and you immediately took ownership of that rather than let people think that this is a thing that you were being trivial about or joking about. You took ownership of that.
Yeah.
But it was really interesting because there's a part of you, I could feel your antenna reacting. You were waiting for that so you could say, okay, let me step in and let the audience know what I'm talking about here.
Right.
That this isn't just a throwaway line. This isn't just shtick. This
isn't
where I live now.
It's not shtick. It's,
And you, to the point you're talking about being a man, this entire show really is about taking ownership of the good and the bad in your life, isn't it?
You have to take ownership from all of it. And you have to be humble to go, I am flawed. Like, all right, so every show, including the ones that I filmed, even though I didn't include those, I do a Q&A after. I do a Q&A every show I do. Once I sort of have grooved for 45 minutes to an hour, I'm like, does anybody have any questions? Ask me anything. Someone asked me if I have any regrets, okay? And I said, I thought about it for a minute or two, and I went, no, I have no regrets. However, I have made many, many mistakes, many mistakes. I am flawed and I've made many mistakes, but I do not have regrets. I do not look back on my life with regret. I do not, not at all. But I know I have screwed up and I'm going to screw up again. Even though I'm a man, there are lots of screw-ups ahead, lots of mess that I'll have to clean up. But I'll look everybody in the eye as I'm cleaning it up going, yes, I'm cleaning up this mess.
In fact, addressing when you misspoke on stage, when she goes, well, that's what this thing is.
Yeah.
Everything's not perfectly worked out.
Which is, by the way, I love that. You know, Netflix has a thing about cleaning that stuff up, like when you make a mistake on stage. Let's not include that. They also don't like including when you see the cameras. Like if I move and you see a camera, generally those are edited out. I fought. And Netflix was great artistically. It wasn't like they said, no, Jeff, and there was a big... They were really cool with me fighting for what it really mattered to me, which was I wanted it to be human. I wanted the special to be, you're there. You're feeling it, you know?
Not much more to say except we're out of time. You have to come back here. It's been too long since you've done this.
By the way, I will come back anytime. You don't understand, and I was saying this to you in the break. So often when I listen to the show, I wish I was sitting in the room, not to ask questions, but to be part of a conversation. And by the way, that's what this is, and that's why it's joyous. It's a conversation. You know, people ask me, like I'll do an interview, they'll ask me my opinion. I go, yeah, get rid of your questions. Just have a conversation with me, and it'll always be interesting.
Okay, we're out of time. I'd rather be in a car with you. Our recording engineer here at NPR West is Patrick Murray. The show is mixed by Kat Yore. I'm going to go watch a John Mulaney special. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.